The Age of Elegance. Around the turn of the century, in Spokane, Washington, there was a way of living. Luxurious, cultured, mannered, formal. One neighborhood in particular portrayed the era, and if you visit Brown's Addition today, you can still see vestiges of its elegant past. The streets are lined by rows of great shade trees. Stately mansions are set back by formal lawns and gardens. The mansions are often encircled by wide porches or piazzas, whose great columns are fluted. Leaded or stained glass windows, gables, even turrets. There are apartment buildings in the neighborhood now, but actually many date back to the turn of the century. The Westminster, with its elegant Tudor exterior, holding tales of great wealth inside its walls. It was an era of music boxes and flowery poetry, formal teas and maids. The neighborhood is still quiet and peaceful. It has many stories to tell. J.J. Brown was a young lawyer living in Portland, Oregon. He was quite successful, respected as the superintendent of schools, but he dreamed of adventures and fortune. At age 35, he left Portland on an exploration trip to eastern Washington. He took a steamboat up the Columbia River. On that same steamboat was an acquaintance, A.M. Cannon. Cannon had been trying to make a living selling vacuum cleaners in Portland. Both had the same dream.
For $5,000 total or $2,500 each, they acquired half interest in James Glover's town site to Spokane Falls.
Curator of History at Eastern Washington State Historical Society, Larry Schoonover.
And they saw, at that point in 1878, Spokane Falls probably had 50 individuals. The population was very small. And it was somewhat of a commercial gamble on their part.
It was a gamble. Cannon and Brown were essentially betting that the falls would attract mill owners and that the Northern Pacific Railroad would decide to come through Spokane, providing the vital link to the outside world. Only then would settlers come to buy land. The first few years were lean. J.J. Brown wrote to his wife while she was away visiting her family back in Portland.
September 18, 1883. My dear wife, this is your birthday, and although I had hoped to send you some money today, I am unable to do so. I will send you some as soon as I can, although I am frightfully pressed for money. Bills coming in on every side, a number of which I have been unable to pay. Yesterday I was very busy trying to sell some lots, but did not succeed. Mr. Cannon was kicked night before last by his horse, breaking his kneecap, and so he is laid up and will be for several days. Hope you are having a good time.
From 1878 to 1883, Spokane really hadn't taken off, and it wasn't until the railroad came through the city in 1881, the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad in 1883, and of course one of the keys to Spokane's success has always been tied to the mining efforts of northern Idaho. And I think when gold was discovered in 83, there was great influx of population, and for a commercial urban center, wealth was beginning to generate.
September 25th, 1883. My dear wife, the Coeur d'Alene gold mines are attracting a great deal of attention. A great many are going there. It is supposed that several hundred are already there. Presume there is considerable gold there. Parties report the making of $20 and $25 a day. The town is full of people, but none seem inclined to buy. I have written to Mr. Corbett in the hopes that I may obtain a loan, but I fear I will not succeed.
But as the word gold spread across the nation, Spokane boomed. Mike Green, Eastern Washington University historian.
J.J. Brown, Anthony Cannon, and the others who formed that townsite company, they're getting land, in some cases homestead land or railroad land, and they're paying a few dollars an acre for it, and they're turning it around and subdividing it and selling it for hundreds of dollars a lot. You know, that's how you can strike it rich.
After years of uncertainty and struggles, Spokane boomed. the population doubling and tripling in just a few years. The land speculators did begin to get rich. J.J. Brown built an elegant three-story home in Brown's Addition. In 1889, he felt prosperous enough to invite his wife's grandmother, a proper Eastern lady, to come from St. Joseph, Michigan, to live with them. Anna Stratton, age 77, described her journey, writing in her diary,
"The Brown party left the Grand Pacific Hotel, Chicago, the 9th of May, 10:30 in the evening, for their western home in Spokane. We took our last meal in the Pullman car Sabbath morning, May 12th. We sat down to the table in a town called Hope, finished as we were passing Sandpoint. The train stopped at Spokane about 11 o'clock. Many friends of Mr. Brown's were at the depot. Mr. Brown sent us home in a carriage, he stopping in town to get shaved. Monday, May 13th. After dinner yesterday, we went to the orchard and garden. Three-year-old trees with apples, pears, peaches, plums, bushes with gooseberries, currants, peas in bloom, lettuce, radishes, splendid in the garden.
Brown's Addition was very attractive and peaceful. Orchards, quiet woods, yet still within walking distance of downtown Spokane. Brown began to sell off lots in his property to merchants and professionals coming to town. Scattered throughout the 160 acres of Brown's Addition, they built lovely Queen Anne family homes, 2 to 3 stories, with gabled roofs and lead-paned Palladian windows. One early settler was a Dr. Newman. His daughter, Marguerite Newman Powell, still lives in Spokane, and she remembers those early days.
My parents moved into Brown's Addition when it was called Brown's Woods. Mother said she was scared to death at night. She was so far out in the country.
The Newman home was on the edge of Brown's Addition on Riverside, the road nearest the river. It led down a steep hill into the valley near Hangman Creek.
Riverside was the main passageway to the section where the Indians camped down on Hangman Creek. And they used to go by. I'd see them as a child. They just went by all the time. They squaws on their little horses that they used to use. And their papooses were on papoose boards at the back of the cayuse. That's the word, a cayuse.
The Indians that Margaret Newman Powell saw as a child were of the middle band of the Spokane Indians. Other bands had moved on to a reservation a few years before.
Gary and his middle Spokanes, there are some upper Spokanes too, continued to live. There were Indians camping in that general area down to about 1917.
The Brown's Addition residents knew the Indians were peaceful, but sometimes families left back east did not understand. Margaret Newman Powell.
My mother wrote to her mother in Indiana that she had a squaw doing her washing. Well, my grandmother, that would be my mother's mother, just was panicked. She wrote back and she said, "Don't you dare turn your back on that squaw for fear she tomahawks you."
Actually, Spokane residents had something far more serious than Indians to worry about: fire. Anna Stratton was visiting at a ranch out in Springdale when she heard the news. She wrote this in her diary.
August 5th, 1889, out at Howard's ranch. He brought the sad news that Spokane was in ashes. All of the business part of the city, post office, banks, the depot, passenger and freight, hotels, stores, caused by a gasoline stove exploding in a hotel. Water could not be obtained to extinguish the fire.
Most Western cities, of course, because they're in this period, are built so hastily and so carelessly, are typically burned out in some kind of spectacular fire. That tend to calm things a little bit. When the cities are rebuilt, usually there's more attention paid to building codes and provisions for fire protection.
Spokane came back with style. One of the first projects was the famed Auditorium, an ornate palace of a theater with the largest stage in the world at that time. It was one sign of the arrival of the Age of Elegance. Another was one Kirkland Kelsey Cutter, building mansions in Brown's edition for the men who'd made a quick fortune in the Idaho mines. For instance, Patrick Clark, or Patsy Clark, an Irishman who struck it rich in silver and lead. He sent Cutter all over the world to get supplies for the home, to Europe for the walnut, mahogany, and onyx for the 9 fireplaces, to Turkey for specially woven rugs, and to Tiffany's for the largest stained glass window ever put in a home. It's still there. The Clark Mansion is now a public restaurant, but it's preserved in its original state. Jeff Clark, grandson of Patsy Clark, still lives here in Spokane. We met at the Clark Mansion, and he showed me some pictures on the wall.
That was Grandma and Grandpa.
Their wedding picture.
Wedding picture, yeah. That's Teddy Roosevelt, president. He came down. I think they had the family carriage for him.
So your grandfather knew Teddy Roosevelt?
Oh, yeah.
How's that?
Well, they get around, you know.
Did he know him from back east?
Back east, yeah. My grandfather had an office in New York on the New York Stock Exchange. He was, had a broker. He was, had a seat and an office there. He operated all over in mining. He was in South Africa, Mexico, and South America.
Jeff Clark lived with his grandparents for part of his childhood. It was a formal house.
We didn't eat at this main dining room until we got pretty well along. Years up in eighth grade, we call it the little dining room. It was right off the kitchen.
And that's where the kids ate.
Yeah, that was our... and Wong, the grandma had a Chinese cook by the name of Wong, and he was a wonderful cook. He was very patient. He made dollar hot cakes, and we'd order what we want, how many dollar hot cakes.
Young ladies of the day also had to learn manners for dinner and formal occasions, but in addition, they were expected to learn a youthful skill. Dorothy Dwight Woodward was born in Brown's edition, and she's lived there all her life. She remembers her youthful training.
They took time for young girls, especially, to learn the arts like fine sewing and fine writing and poetry and artwork and china painting. After school, we'd go over to grandmother's and maybe we'd hem half of one side of a napkin while we were over there visiting. We were always busy.
Dorothy Woodward has a memento from her grandmother, something very common in Brown's edition homes enjoyed by adults and children.
It plays a little madrigal.
Artistic skills were valued and encouraged. Dorothy's sister, Mae Dwight, became a very well-known poet and painter.
When she was painting, she did all kinds of artwork. She did pastel, she did oil, she did watercolor. They painted all kinds of subjects. They painted landscapes, and they painted flowers, and they painted gardens, and some people painted older houses. And
Mae Dwight also wrote poetry.
She had correspondence paper like this. She liked to put this spring poem in there. And this is called This is Spring. Spring is a lad leaping out to the river, tossing his cap in the velvety air, peering for minnows where small ripples quiver, shouting up gaily at winds in his hair. Frost becomes dewdrops converted by kisses, dropped by the sun in the valley and slope. Bluebirds are choosing a Mr. and Mrs., blending their voices with carols of hope. Mary Elizabeth Dwight.
Josephine Murphy Carter also still lives in Brown's edition in the house she was born in. As a young girl, she had a formal debut at the then-new Davenport Hotel.
my sister and I made our debut down there. It was in the Hall of the Doge, Chivoni, and we had our dresses from Paris on, my sister and I.
Who would be invited?
Well, we and what happened, the older group, my mother had her friends. They, of course, they were my father and mother, very old timers, in the receiving line, and some of the older people came there, and young marriage came. But then the young crowd came in later, a couple of hours later, and then everybody danced. It's almost like a wedding business. Well, I don't know what it was supposed to be, very stylish.
And Josephine Udan Brewer remembers dinner parties in Brown's Addition just after the turn of the century.
Well, they were simply magnificent because the china and the silverware and so forth, and linens were gorgeous. I mean, even as a kid, I just loved it, you know. Everybody dressed to the teeth.
In what? Long gowns?
Yeah.
Corsets?
Yeah. Oh, heavens, yes. And there were so many parties then, and the men, you know, of course, had to get up and go off to their jobs every morning.
Right.
But around 12 o'clock, I can remember we sat around and put toothpicks, cut off toothpicks or matches, to prop up our eyes, you know. And, of course, you go into hysterics over this with fatigue.
You know. So they would have parties on weeknights, too.
Oh heavens, yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh.
It really must have been awfully tough on the men.
The men did work hard, also the women, in keeping a pleasant and formal home for the men. There were no labor-saving devices. Rugs were beaten by hand, all the fine linens and clothes scrubbed on a washboard. The huge mansions would have been physically impossible for any woman to keep up, and so each home had help. The William H. Coles family had a beautiful home in the far end of Brown's Addition, looking out over the river. Mrs. Margaret Coles recalls their household.
In a house of that size, there had to be a cook and a downstairs maid and an upstairs maid, and a laundress who came every day of the week because they used tablecloths, linen tablecloths, and linen napkins, and all of that had to be ironed, and of course the sheets. But it meant that there was all that linen to be done, and then, of course, the grounds required two gardeners and a helper in the busy season. And then with the horses, what turned out to be the garage when we were there, of course, there were three levels. There was the level where the carriages were kept, and then a ramp that went down. The barn was built on the slope toward the river, and a ramp that went down to where the horses were kept. Then on the upper floor, there was a hayloft and the quarters for the coachman and the gardener. The maids lived in the house.
Yeah.
The gardener and the coachman lived in the barn. Then there was a telephone communication between the barn and the house, but no direct telephone out from the barn. So they could call down when they wanted the carriage, or if the gardener and the coachman wanted to communicate with the cook, they could call up. And, of course, all these people, besides eating their meals, they all came up for tea at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, or 3:30, I think it was. So you see, there almost had to be a staff to look after the staff.
Yeah, they'd come for tea where? To the kitchen?
To the kitchen, yes. And the kitchen, when the house was remodeled, there was a servant's sitting room as well as the main kitchen. But to have, you know, maybe five helpers coming for tea.
Who was kind of in charge? Was it the cook who kind of...
Well...
Or did it vary with the household?
No, well, it was pretty... They were pretty much in their own territories. You had to be careful that, you know, that isn't my work sort of thing. And who was to clean the stairs between the first floor and the second, and the stairways between the second floor and the third floor. And those things had to be very clearly set out. I wrote out a daily schedule for each person who worked so that they knew when they were to do what.
Really?
And where the boundaries were. And it made a considerably more formal life out of it, of course, because you were always careful not to talk about family things at the table.
Uh-huh.
And you had to, if you were going to discuss those things, you did it in the bedroom where there was no one around.
I see. I see.
Margaret Bean was born before the turn of the century. She grew up on the South Hill and remembers when there was a rivalry between Brown's Addition and South Hill, each claiming to be the most prestigious neighborhood. Margaret Bean has written much history herself, including a description of what was perhaps the height of formality in the Age of Elegance, the afternoon visits between the ladies of the Hill and the ladies of Brown's Addition. She writes, "They always left their visiting cards on a silver tray, which the maid, who opened the door, presented. The cards of the Hill ladies bore Wednesdays on the left-hand corner, and those of Brown's Addition ladies bore Thursdays. In making their calls, the ladies were driven by their liveried coachmen. In landaus and phaetons during the summer, in the summers they would shield themselves from the sun by elaborate parasols, fluffy with lace or ruffles, parasols being one of the more important accessories of the day. And while the coachman held the high-spirited horses tightly reined in on the street, sometimes with a cocklebur under each horse's tail to make it hold it at a smarter angle, the tightly corseted collar, wearing an elaborate afternoon gown that brushed the ground, and with a hat secured to a pompadour by long hat-pins, sat uncomfortably straight in a gold chair and made stilted conversation with her hostess, also tightly corseted. It is a question as to which was the more uncomfortable, the collar or her horses. The ladies in their carriages had to be careful not to run into another parade of ladies in the afternoon.
Every afternoon at 4 o'clock, of course you know about Dutch Jake, he had what would be a casino. I forgot whether there were 4 or 6 floors, and it was a very handsome building and a very handsome casino. It was just the same as Las Vegas, only it's much more elaborate down there. But it was the finest casino on the West Coast. Men who went there, we didn't think much of them, but they didn't let us know they went. And he didn't deal in women, but he had a theater. And every afternoon, the woman who ran the ladies of the night and Dutch Jake's actresses, at 4 o'clock, they'd have a parade down Riverside Avenue in carriages. And the madams showing off their girls, and Dutch Jake showing off his theater girls.
Would they be all dressed with plumes?
Oh, yes, I imagine so, because plumes were very fashionable. It was a great sight, so every man was on deck at 4 o'clock to look at that parade.
A saloon life was vigorous in Spokane. We're talking about Brown's Addition. It's quiet, wealthy, genteel, respectability. Was a stark contrast to the wide-open drinking and gambling establishments in downtown Spokane. Spokane was a wide-open city. There were the variety theaters. This would be one establishment. There were the boxes, the curtain boxes around the sides of the theater, and there you could relax and drink, play cards, and the boxes were visited by actresses, quote-unquote, who could keep you company and provide other entertainment if you wanted to. And rustling the boxes was a common term for that activity. Prostitution was widespread in Spokane, widespread. It was a serious issue. It disturbed the respectable elements in the city, and it was also becoming a city of families and churches and schools and middle-class respectable people. They did not like what was going on.
One of the most popular family activities in Spokane and Brown's Addition was the Family Sunday Drive, and J.J. Brown left a park to the city perfect for families. Mary Margaret Hawes Burns.
Coeur d'Alene Park was a beautiful park in those days, and it had openings on the sides, on the north and south sides, and the people in their carriages would come and ride around there, and they had a fountain in the center of the park, and they also had a bandstand where they had concerts. The ladies would drive down there, or the people on Sunday would drive down there in their carriages. And it was just some place to go.
As much to be seen as to
yes,
go out.
Oh yes. Oh, well, dressed up with their veils and things, and their horses, and they... And it was a beautiful park, beautifully kept up.
The park was not like it is today. They didn't have those big, tall trees. The park was just a lot of smaller trees. The trees hadn't grown up. When Brown built that park down there, he put every known tree that would live in the northwest into that park. Every known tree, like oaks and firs and spruces and magnolias and dogwood, there's still some of them are still there.
Jack Woodruff has lived in Brown's Addition much of his life. Years ago, when he was just 10 years old or so, he was a paper boy in Brown's Addition.
Carried a review. I got up at 2:30 in the morning, and I delivered approximately 500 dailies. I used to sit in the, waiting for the papers in the Avenida Apartments. And you had to be on time. You had to be there when the truck got there, or you were fined 50 cents. A lot of people were up. Lights were on in the house because the cooks were up getting ready for breakfast and setting the tables, probably. And the streetcars, about 5 o'clock, streetcars start running.
We'll join Jack Woodruff next week to finish his early morning newspaper rounds. And then we'll go inside some of the homes to visit the families of the Brown's Addition. Voices of the Age of Elegance, a program funded in part by the Washington Commission for the Humanities, a project of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Also, support was given by the Eastern Washington State Historical Society. I'm Mary Mittige for Spokane Public Radio, KPBX. Voices from the Age of Elegance. There was a brief glittering period in our history just at the turn of this century when there was a style of elegant living and formal manners. Afternoon teas and calling cards, maids in little white caps, ladies with their parasols, and men in top hats. The men had come west to seek their fortune. Some struck it rich, and vast wealth flowed from the mines of northern Idaho and British Columbia into Spokane, Washington, hub of the Inland Empire. Spokane was a rough boom town filled with saloons and gambling casinos, but just a few blocks away there was a serene and elegant neighborhood, Brown's Addition, where the wealthy and prominent built lavish homes and great mansions. The ladies created a formal society of culture and refinement. Let's go back to the turn of the century to find out what life was like inside the homes of the Age of Elegance. It's very early in the morning. Dawn is just beginning to show in the sky. Down the street comes a solitary figure, a newsboy, tossing papers up onto the porches of the mansions. Nearly 70 years ago, Jack Woodruff was that newsboy. He remembers what Brown's Addition was like.
Very quiet. Birds in the spring. By the time I'd get up, they'd be starting to sing. Every once in a while, you'd hear somebody emptying the ashes in the big homes. They all had furnaces, see, and they had to empty their ashes. And you hear them out in the back dumping the ashes. But a lot of homes took two or three papers. One for the chauffeur, one for the cook, one for his wife, maybe one for himself. Lights were on in the house because the cooks were up getting ready for breakfast. Imagine the man of the house would be getting up, but 6 o'clock, get ready to go to work. The trains, they kept you company. The old steam engines kept puffing up the grade out of Stafford's Addition. And the streetcars, about 5 o'clock, streetcars start running. And the milk wagon, I used to meet them at the bridge. When I got through with the papers, I'd meet them at the Hangman Bridge. I'd give him a paper, and he'd give me a quart of milk, and then we'd meet the bread man and the donut man, and I'd give him a paper for a dozen donuts, and he was delivering the fresh bread to the homes. And that's about the time I was getting through. 5 o'clock, they'd be started in, and I'd be just getting through 5 and 6 o'clock.
By 7 o'clock, some of Spokane's most prominent citizens, department store owners, lawyers, and bank presidents, would be ready to leave for work. Some rode the horse-drawn streetcar. Others walked down the dirt streets. There were rows of small saplings along the streets and vacant lots filled with wildflowers between the mansions. Behind the largest mansions was a pasture for the carriage horses and the family cow. The owner of one of the largest mansions was Amasa Campbell.
Mace Campbell, born in Salem, Ohio, 1845, youngest of 10 children.
Larry Schoonover, curator of the Eastern Washington State Historical Society.
His father passed away before Mr. Campbell was born, and I think being the youngest of 10 children, probably had to fend for himself. He would epitomize that adventurous pioneer spirit who went west and found his pot of gold.
The pot of gold was actually some gold and a lot of silver and lead from the Coeur d'Alene mining district. Campbell, college educated from a good middle class Ohio family, came west at age 45. Using cash from rich eastern investors, he bought up mines, and within a few years he was a millionaire himself. He moved from the rough mining town of Wallace, Idaho, to a freshly built mansion in Brown's Addition. Today, that mansion has been restored by the Eastern Washington State Historical Society. Curator of Collections, Lynn Hemmert.
This was typical for the Age of Elegance. A lot of carving, dark paneling, the Persian and Turkish rugs, and you notice the flowered wallpaper, the poppy design, the gold leaf in the entryway, and the cupid heads on the beams, and the armor above the door, and the shields used as chandeliers.
These people, having made their money, wished to display it.
Mike Green, historian at Eastern Washington University.
Most of them were nouveau riche. That is, they didn't represent old money. They were lucky, hard-working, entrepreneurial types who managed, through luck and their own efforts and ambition, to strike it rich in this region. And so they wanted to display their success, and they built fancy homes in places like Brown's Addition.
The fountains and the water, it was just a style. Most of the time they were outside. They're landscaped yards, things like this. And, of course, that comes from Europe. And
little statues.
Oh, yes. We must have our art. And there were many what we call Victorian reproductions. They would take masters, and they would copy them. And, of course, those were favorites for the Victorian times. In those times, it fit. That was the lifestyle these people led. They dressed elaborately and lived elaborately.
And curtains everywhere.
Oh, yes, yes. You didn't, you know, this house, as in most of the Victorian homes around here, had the pocket doors. They were all inset within the wall. You simply pushed a button, a small brass handle came out, and you would pull it open. And usually they were good, solid wood. But rather than using these pocket doors, they would hang curtains, such as here in the Campbell House. It's velvet and suede curtains. And then on the back, it was a heavy tapestry. There's one hanging down in the entry to the living room. But even entry to the dining room, same thing.
And in this formal dining room, after Mr. Campbell is left for work, a maid in black dress and white apron would be clearing the china and silver and linen napkins used even for breakfast. The Campbell's only child, Helen, would be upstairs dressing for school. Helen had a friend named Margaret Bean, who still lives in Spokane. Miss Bean remembers how complicated it was for a child to dress.
We had longies and high shoes, and they were either laced or buttoned. Then you had what was called a Ferris waist that had all kinds of buttons on it. In the wintertime, you always have a flannel skirt, and that buttoned on there. And then over that, you had a white linen skirt. As spring came, we were just crazy to get out of these longies.
The tradition was you get out of your longies or leggings when all the snow was melted from Mount Spokane. But Helen Campbell usually wasn't so lucky. She was an only child and protected.
Helen Campbell's mother was, such a mother that she just wouldn't let her hardly do anything. When we on the hill all had our longies off, Helen would still have to wear them.
But even after getting rid of the longies, there was still the hot flannel skirt. And typically, Helen Campbell was wearing her flannel skirt long after the other girls, or so her mother thought.
There was a granite wall. Well, on the way to school, Helen would go in there and take her flannel petticoat off and hide it under a bush, and then go to school like the rest of us were. And then when she'd come home, she'd stop and put on her flannel skirt and go on home.
So her mother never knew.
Another childhood friend of Helen Campbell's was Mary Margaret Hawes Byrne. Her father was president of Spokane Drug Company. With all the other young Brown's Addition residents, she attended Washington School.
It was a booming school. Brown's Addition was a big, important area, and they took care of all the children of Brown's Addition.
The school also took all the children from Peaceful Valley, a tiny cluster of houses below Brown's Addition, down the steep hill beside the river. Peaceful Valley was almost a little Scandinavia of recent immigrants, blue-collar workers, many quite poor. The Peaceful Valley children often couldn't even speak English when they entered the first grade.
And they would have fights, the boys, not the girls. They would have fights with the Brown's Addition boys, particularly in winter when there was snowballing. The feeding was quite bitter, and they would have wars. Yes, different backgrounds. I suppose the Brown's Addition children high-hatted.
While the children were getting a somewhat democratic experience at school, back at home, their mothers and the maids would be going about the morning chores. Mrs. Tina Anderson was the second maid in the Galland household in Brown's Addition. The second maid did the cleaning and helped serve meals.
When the breakfast was over, I would do the dusting and make the beds. And I even crawled around the floor. They had hardwood floors. They didn't have rugs like we do now.
Right.
They had rugs, but it was a space between the rug and the wall. So I crawled around and dusted the floor, too, see? And the furniture. And on Wednesday was the day I had to polish silver. It was a specialty. And even, but they had a comb and brush and mirror on the dressers upstairs in the bedrooms. And the top part, you know, was silver. That had to be cleaned, too, and put back.
If the lady of the house wished to summon the maid, the larger houses, like the Campbell Mansion, had call boxes. Curator Lynn Hemmert.
This is the call box, and this was situated in the servants' sitting room. And in each one of the rooms, that's indicated the front door, side door, rear door, reception room, library, dining room, in the bedrooms, there were call buttons, usually mother of pearl call buttons. And when they needed a maid or someone to help them, they would push one of these fancy buttons, and then it would ring down here in the sitting room. They would be summoned to the appropriate room. The little gold arrows that are next to each one of the designated rooms, then they would move and they would be able to see which room they were wanted in. Of course, the bell would attract their attention.
For instance, the lady could call the cook and tell her what dinner she'd planned and what groceries would be arriving.
They had the groceries coming every day, every day. The lady would call in the morning and have the things come, and it was delivered by a grocery boy.
Mrs. Margaret Coles, another early resident of Brown's Addition, remembers ordering the daily groceries.
You telephoned and told them what you wanted, and Greenough's, which was one of the early stores, they would deliver twice a day, not just once, but twice. In case you were having a dinner party and you had ordered things in the morning and you discovered you needed a pint of cream, oh, no, you didn't get a pint of cream from them. That came from the milkman. But if you needed something that you didn't have, they would run up with it. Of course, the Crescent store used to deliver a spool of thread. If your dressmaker got stuck and we needed a little more thread, you'd telephone down. They'd deliver a spool of thread.
There was not yet ready-made clothing in stores, so dressmakers came to the home a couple times a year and spent a day or a week or however long it took to sew new clothes for the whole family. The clothes were very fancy, even the youngest children's clothes. Mrs. Coles showed me her family album.
And of course, the little boys wore knickers and long stockings.
All summer, too?
Oh, yes, yes. And, of course, the boys, when they were little, they wore dresses and bonnets like little girls. Now, that's a boy.
That's a boy?
Yeah.
Now, how would I have not looked? Long curls?
You wouldn't know. And they were so mad, and he had a bow. That I have a portrait of my husband with a hair bow and a lace collar, and he looked so mad. And the little girls, now, this was my sister-in-law, and she was about six, I expect.
And she's got this great, wide-brimmed, fluffy hat.
Yeah, and here is her mother in a big hat and a parasol. My mother-in-law was one of 11 children, and there were four girls in a row, and so they would, when they were dressing to go out, they'd stand in a circle and hook each other up. Here she is.
Now, how could a child have kept clean dressed like this?
Well, I don't think they did. I think that, and of course, that meant all that laundry and that starching of the dresses.
In the large Coles household, a laundress came in every day. In the smaller Gallant home, the laundress came in once a week. Tina Anderson.
She came in and rubbed on the board. And then ironed and had to heat the irons on the stove. Have you ever seen those irons? Oh, boy. Yeah.
Heavy.
Yeah, they were heavy. Yeah, they. Everything had to be ironed almost in those days. They ironed just dresses and blouses and shirts. Oh, the men's shirts were the hardest things to do. Because she started early in the morning. And she'd have to pick a good day, you know, to hang the clothes out. And then I guess she must have ironed in the afternoon.
What about spring cleaning? Did you have to do the big, hard?
Spring cleaning. Then we took these rugs out on the lawn and used a thing with a big wire thing and pounded the dust. And then take the broom and sweep them off and pound them some more and sweep them off and bring them back in. And then we had to wax the floors, too. And that was the hardest part, to wax the hardwood floor and polish it with a flannel rag. We didn't have a brush to stand up and push around.
Tina Anderson was born in Minnesota, but many maids in Brown's edition were Scandinavian.
They call them foreigners from Norway and Sweden and even Germany. Young people came from there in those days to get work.
In the case of the Inland Empire, they were attracted by the advertisements and the very dedicated promotional efforts of the Northern Pacific Railroad.
Historian Mike Green.
They conducted advertising campaigns, really colonization campaigns in Europe. There were nearly 1,000 Northern Pacific agents and promoters traveling throughout Europe, and they sent samples of agricultural produce grown in the Inland Empire and described it in the most glowing terms.
Often when they arrived, they didn't speak English. Marguerite Newman Powell grew up as a child in Brown's edition. She remembers her mother's maid.
There was one girl that came over from Italy, and I remember her kneeling beside my mother. Mother was liked to sew, and she would come when she had any spare time. This girl, I think her name was Madeline. And she would kneel beside Mother and just look at Mother and watch how her lips move for certain words, you know, in trying to learn the English language.
And so they came and worked in the Brown's edition households. Tina Anderson.
At noon after lunch, I had to be dressed up to answer the door, visitors to see the lady. Oh, yes, and they had calling cards. If the lady wasn't home, they'd leave their calling card on a little silver plate by the door.
When you said on your calling card that you were at home on Thursdays, why, you'd have a tea tray. If there were just three or four people, why, you'd poured your own. And the maid, of course, had a little white cap and a white apron and white cuffs and would let people in and would pass the food and they would visit a little bit and then get up and go.
Mrs. Margaret Coles. Like the Coles household, the Campbell home was formal, with a very formal front room for visiting ladies. Curator Lynn Hemmert.
This is the formal sitting room. This is where Mrs. Campbell would greet her guests. And of course, we have velvet draperies with lace curtains behind them, water silk, or we call it moye, on the walls. And it's all this deep rose color. And the gold and onyx fireplace, again, quite elaborate as far as the fixtures, and the ceiling is all curlicues and cupids and flowers, and just a real feeling of elegance.
Margaret Coles.
Then, of course, there were big teas, which my mother-in-law referred to as jail deliveries. She'd say it was about time that we should have a jail delivery, which meant all those people she was indebted to are the people that she thought she should entertain, and then would invite a lot of people, and usually have someone play the harp or have some musical thing before the tea, and then have really a jail delivery, a lot of people.
One of the other activities that occupied ladies in the afternoon was clubs. Dorothy Woodward, lifelong resident of Brown's edition.
Mother belonged to a Cullis Club, which was a literary club. It was a study club. They studied all kinds of everything. Mother wrote songs for different occasions that they had. And they met in the homes and had a lovely luncheon, and then they'd have this program. And somebody'd read a paper that... Well, Mother did a lot of research and study for the Cullis Club.
And one of the earliest civic improvement clubs was the Spokane Cirrhosis. It's still in existence 93 years later. It was formed to create a library, first in City Hall. Mike Green.
This is the getting into the progressive period in American history. It's a period of considerable reform efforts across the country. And American cities are the centers for a lot of this reform activity, and women are quite conspicuous as reformers. American cities grew so fast, and Spokane is an excellent example, that a number of problems were created. The boom period did produce the opportunity for criminal activity, organized vice. In most cities, prostitution and gambling flourished despite ordinances
prohibiting it. And so there was a protection racket that usually involved the police department. Police provided protection for the illicit operators. A typical arrangement was $10 per prostitute per month. Decent women in Spokane were outraged by this.
And so, through their clubs, the women helped transform Spokane into a city of decency and families. The men, too, had their clubs, but mostly for relaxing. Mary Margaret Hawes Burns' father was president of Spokane Drug Company.
He belonged to Spokane Club. He went to the events there. They had a large lounge there. And he'd go down there often after dinner. They would have the papers from New York and everything, and he enjoyed that.
The men and women of Spokane kept close tabs on the news, trends, and fashions of the East Coast. Historian Mike Green.
Western cities have a kind of inferiority complex that they're new and their features are raw. They lack the polished, settled, elegant sophistication of older Eastern cities, and so they want to demonstrate to the world that they've made it. And one of the first things that they'll build, of course, is a theater. And Spokane was so anxious to demonstrate its coming of age that when the Auditorium Theater was built, they made sure that its stage was 1 foot, what was it, 1 foot wider and 1 foot deeper than the largest stage in America at that time.
Another way the Westerners kept up with their East Coast cousins was to send young ladies back east to finishing schools. Many of the Brown's Edition ladies went to Miss Capon's school in Northampton, Massachusetts. There they learned manners and skills such as social note writing, perhaps a little art or music. Some did go on to college, but others had a different education, such as Josephine Murphy Carter.
My sister and I, we went to Europe instead. Doesn't that sound grand? We went over there and stayed 3 years, our whole family did. My father decided that that was the thing to do. We had a winter in Dresden and went to German schools, and then we traveled every summer and went around. It was considered the thing to do, and a great many of our friends did. And there was a very large, at that time, an enormous colony of Americans. We had a wonderful time.
When they came home from Europe, college or finishing school, the young ladies were expected to find a good husband and marry. Actually, even the young maids from Scandinavia or Europe would also tend to leave their jobs and marry as soon as they'd learned English and met a fine young man. Tina Anderson says they usually met other young people at the Swedish or German church.
We had basket socials in those days. We fixed a shoebox that had to be trimmed, you know, with fancy tissue paper, and then we fixed a lunch in there for two, and then they were auctioned off, you know, and that made the money for the church. And then, of course, you had your name in there, so whoever bought it, you ate with that man that bought our baskets.
Was there competition to make the prettiest looking box?
Oh, yes. Some of them made them very, very fancy. They made flowers out of tissue paper and they put ribbons on and bows and, oh, yeah, they were really fancy.
One of their other favorite activities was on their Sunday afternoons off.
We had a train, electric train, that went from Spokane to Liberty Lake. And we'd fix up a shoebox with sandwiches and go to the park on the train.
Meanwhile, the young ladies and gentlemen and families of Brown's Edition were also going to Liberty Lake for picnics, only they went by a new conveyance, the car. Mary Margaret Hawes Burns.
Well, we went riding. Wore special coats for riding because of the dust, and special hats. Not everybody had a car, but my father enjoyed his car, and we went riding. We'd go up to the little towns. Out.
The car was one sign of change in Spokane and in the nation and in the world. Life was going to speed up now, and the age of elegance would begin to disappear. World War I broke out in Europe. It didn't touch America, and particularly the distant West, for several more years. But when it did, young men went off to war. And for the first time, women could get jobs. Clerical, shopkeeper, nurses. Also, a new generation was coming along, and the older generation passing away. The parents of those who you heard speak today, the founders of the Age of Elegance, were in their 50s and 60s. Death came earlier in those days. Larry Schoonover.
So we see the passing of a generation that had that wealth. Much of the money was fragmented from, say, one individual. If there was a larger family with five or six children, the financial wealth was distributed. Social conditions like World War I created a much more difficult period of time to really maintain that economic holding.
The sense of formality and elegance passed into the Roaring Twenties.
Probably the Roaring Twenties are somewhat that social counterbalance to an age of elegance. If it was a very rigid lifestyle, as we move into the 20s, the early 30s, what we probably see are the children of the members of the age of elegance somewhat reacting to the way they were raised.
And the original families began to move out of Brown's Addition.
We're looking at structures in Brown's Addition, which are very, very large. At one point in time when fuel was cheap, help was cheap, individuals could afford to maintain those structures. As we move into the 20th century, it's much more difficult to not only heat the homes, but maintain the homes. You really could not afford to hire three or four live-in servants plus a chauffeur, a gardener, to maintain those residences. And that somewhat symbolizes why in Brown's Addition today most of those large, elegant structures have been apartmentalized, and they are multi-family residential dwellings.
Larry Schoonover, curator of the Eastern Washington State Historical Society. Today, when you drive down the streets of Brown's Addition, the mansions are almost all apartments, and there are new, modern apartment buildings added. The neighborhood has changed, but the quiet streets and the still existing mansions do give a sense of past history. The Historical Society has preserved and restored the Campbell House as a museum where you can see the vestiges of the Age of Elegance in Brown's Addition. Voices from the Age of Elegance was funded in part by the Washington Commission for the Humanities, a program of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Support also from the Eastern Washington State Historical Society. I'm Mary Mittige. This program was produced in the studios of KPBX, Spokane Public Radio.